and had no chance to escape. Mary was my half-sister. We shared our mother, Lillian. Mary was only 27 years old when she died. In 6 months, my mother had lost her mother, daughter, and brother. I was not a superstitious kid, but I worried that I had jinxed our family when I'd left the res school. But then I reasoned, hey, I still live on the res. I just go to a different school. There's no reason for our family to be cursed. Today, as a non-superstitious adult, I still worry that I'm at fault. It's a ridiculous, narcissistic worry, but real nonetheless. At my sister's funeral, my mother tried to climb into her coffin. My mother screamed in the tribal language. She wailed in English. My mother screamed, "Mother." My mother screamed, "Brother." My mother screamed, "Daughter." My mother collapsed and said my sister's name. She said, "Mary, oh Mary, Mary, oh my daughter, oh Mary." Of course, it was a prayer. That prayer sounded so powerful that I wondered if my mother might bring my sister back to life. But she didn't. Nobody has that kind of power. Even God has brought back only a fistful of people. And my mother was not God. Then my mother wailed so loudly that I thought she'd snapped her ribs. I think something broke inside her. But not something anatomical. I believe that she broke her capacity to fully love the rest of her children. Or maybe to fully love me. Or maybe to fully love herself. That audible snap I heard, that crack of bone, was maybe her soul snapping in half. That night, I traveled back to Reardon to play in a basketball game. I scored 17 first-quarter points in a frenzied, irrational burst as I dribbled end-to-end without sense, fired up impossible shots that went in and shoved my opponents and teammates into walls and to the floor. At the end of the quarter, I was enraged and exhausted, and I screamed at my teammates. My coach benched me after my outburst, and I became a spectator for the rest of the game. Afterward, in the locker room, my coach said, "I'm sorry I sat you, but you were playing too hard. You were going to hurt yourself or somebody else." "It's okay, coach," I said. "You were right." "You didn't have to play tonight," he said. "Yes, I did," I said. "This is my team now. These are my teammates." I was talking in sports metaphors. But I was also talking about my tribal allegiances. My brilliant sister had died drunk in a fire. I feared, I knew, that I would die violently like that if I ever returned to my res. I would die in a fire, in a car wreck, in a brawl, by my own hand. At that moment, sitting in that white school locker room with my white coach and white teammates, I knew I would never again fully be a part of my reservation. I knew I was going to be a nomad. I decided to live. Later, after the game, when I returned home to the res, my mother was sedated and asleep in the back bedroom. I stood in the doorway and listened to her breathe. I mourned with her and for her. She lost her mother, brother, and daughter to the next world. And I understood that she'd also lost me. She didn't cry out my name. She didn't whisper it. I was now a ghost in her world. She was already haunted by who I might have become. Awake, I wept. My mother, still asleep, reached her hand towards somebody only she could see. I whispered, "I love you," and walked, grief-drunk and afraid, into the rest of my life. Chapter 74. Unsaved. At Reardon, I became something of a boarding school student. After late-night events, I would often stay over with friends rather than drive in the dark back to the reservation. I slept a few times in the high school locker room on piles of laundered towels. If my car was running and the weather was good, I might sleep in the back seat. During winter, when the road between my reservation and Reardon was unnavigable, I would sometimes sleep on a couch in the basement of the Lutheran church. Yeah, I was the Indian taking refuge with the Christians. Rather ironic, isn't it? And cinematic, too, in a Frank Capra dark subtext sort of way. But it wasn't completely cinematic because, if it had been a movie, I would have kissed the Lutheran minister's daughter. I would have made out with the preacher's kid. But I never did kiss her. She'd already graduated high school and was off to college by the time I was sleeping on that Lutheran couch. I never enjoyed the spiritually ironic privilege of kissing any preacher's daughter. But I did marry a Native American woman with a master's in theology. So you know, I have made babies with a Christian. Yep, some ironies can be tender sacraments that feel great in the dark and in the light. Chapter 75. Skin. I don't remember my first pimple. But I do remember at age 17 when I stood at the bathroom mirror and counted 47 zits on my face. Who knows how much body dysmorphia I was experiencing at that moment. I've never read a scientific study about the psychological effects of having extensive acne, but I do remember feeling freakish and ugly. I felt disfigured. At age 50, I still have to use a variety of acne treatment soaps and moisturizers. There's something poetic about one of my crow's feet wrinkles reaching toward a zit as if it were a raspberry dropped on a brown dirt road. My face doesn't appear to be acne scarred, not at first or second glance. My brown skin seems to camouflage a lot of the damage, but in certain lights and at certain angles, and especially in black and white photos, my acne scars become more evident. Or maybe they don't. Maybe I am hyper aware of them. After reading early drafts of this chapter, many friends told me that they'd never noticed my scars. So do I still have the scars? Am I seeing something that is not there? Maybe I've never stopped being that poor Indian teenager, staring into the mirror at his ravaged face. I am especially self-conscious of the acne scars on my back. A decade ago, my younger son saw my back as I was changing my shirt in the laundry room. I hadn't realized he was there. He later asked his mother, my wife, if my back had been burned. "No," my wife said. "Your father had really bad acne, and those are his scars." "Why didn't he use medicine?" my son asked. "Your dad was too poor to get good health care," my wife said. "Nobody ever gave him the right medicine." "Is that why Dad gets after us about washing our faces?" my son asked. "Yes," she said. "It's true. I have been diligent about my son's complexions. I've been paranoid. Thank God they have both inherited their mother's clear and lovely skin. But I started buying my sons the most scientifically effective acne soap and lotions as soon as they entered puberty. For me, wash your face is another way to say, I love you." My mother and father had clear skin. My siblings all have clear skin. I don't know why I was the only one marked by acne. But sometimes I wonder if I was scarred by evil forces, or if I am the evil one who was scarred as a warning to others. Well, I don't actually believe in that kind of superstitious bullshit. And yet, when I was in sixth grade on the reservation, I witnessed an Indian girl getting bullied by an Indian boy. He was a tall and handsome star athlete from one of the more socially powerful families on the reservation. She was a member of a powwow family, not ostracized but not popular. Her family were all dancers, singers, drummers, and stick game players. They were, to use a native idiom, traditional. And they were also rumored to possess sumesh, a Salish word that translates most simply as magic, but is best understood by non-Salish people as the equivalent of the Force in Star Wars mythology. So yes, that bullied girl was a Spokane Indian Jedi. Or maybe, given her age, she was only a Padawan, a Jedi apprentice, a beginner at sumesh. But I wasn't thinking about magic when I witnessed that popular kid stand over that traditional girl's desk and whisper, "You're ugly." "Leave me alone," she said. "You're the ugliest girl in the whole school," he whispered. "Shut up," she said. Tears welled in her eyes. She was trying not to cry. There was nothing worse than crying. If you cried on my reservation, then even your best friends would make fun of you. "You are the ugliest girl on the whole res," he whispered. She wept. Tears rolled down her face and dropped onto her desk. Other Indians laughed at her. I'd like to say I didn't laugh at her, but I don't remember. I was among the most bullied kids, and defending other bullied kids only earned you another beating, so I probably laughed at her. "You are the ugliest Indian girl in the world," he whispered. That was all she could endure. Only 12 years old, she rose from her desk, pointed at that bully, and said, "I curse you! I curse you! I curse you! You are going to be the ugly one! You are always going to be the ugly one!" Almost everybody laughed, but she scared the shit out of me. Her little girl voice had sounded so adult, so old and scratchy, so grandmotherly. Or maybe I only imagined it sounded like that. A week later, the bully, so handsome and clean, came to school with a zit on his face. Within a month, his face was more ravaged by acne than even mine would be later. He would be acne-scarred until he died of cancer in his late 30s. That girl had cursed him. And well, fuck me, it seemed like the curse was real. The curse had worked. Of course, that popular kid had just entered his teen years, the age of acne, and he had to suffer through the same shitty health care as the rest of us. So there are logical, economic, and banal reasons for the sudden onset of his acne. And yet, my skin started to go bad when I left the reservation to attend the farmtown high school 22 miles away. So I have often wondered, irrationally, if I had been cursed for leaving my people. I wondered if I was the victim of dark sumesh. It's more bullshit, right? I was just another kid with acne, yes? And okay, my acne was more extensive and long-lasting than most other people's acne. But that is all scientifically explainable, isn't it? After all, I was a poor Indian teenager who had left his tribe for a town full of white strangers. So, hormones, plus stress, plus poor health care, equals horrific acti. When I was a kid, I once asked my mother if Sumesh was real. And she said, "It's real if you believe it's real." As an adult, I once asked my mother why she didn't get me better health care for my skin. And she said, "I didn't think there was anything that could be done." If my mother were still alive, I think I would ask her if there was ever a time when she felt powerful. As for me, well, my life is miraculous. I tell stories for a living. How amazing is that? As a storyteller, I sometimes feel like the most traditional kind of Indian. And once in a great while, I feel like I possess a shard of that good Sumesh. But I have rarely allowed anybody to touch the most sensitive skin on my back. I've ordered massage and physical therapists to avoid my scars. I have never allowed myself to be that vulnerable, not even to my wife of 24 years. I don't believe that I was cursed by an enemy. I don't actually believe in Sumesh. But I still wouldn't be shocked to learn that I've been continually cursing myself for leaving my reservation, for fleeing from my tribe, for abandoning the place where my mother was born and where she died. So yes, sometimes I stand at my mirror and I strain my neck and turn my head so I can see the full of my back. And yes, I still feel disfigured. "Look at those scars," the mirror whispers. "Look at those scars. Look at those scars. That is the skin of the boy who changed his destiny." Chapter 76, Missionary Position. In my rural conservative Christian public high school, 22 miles from my reservation, I was the only Indian except for the mascot. That's the one-line joke about my racial isolation. Truthfully, by the time I graduated, I was one of 5 Indians in that high school. 2 of them were my sisters. Despite this racial isolation, I was, at various times, the captain of the basketball team, president of the Future Farmers of America, and prom royalty. During my sophomore year, as I shared a table at the local pizza place with 5 white friends, we watched a drunk and disheveled Indian stagger inside and slump at the bar. He yelled unintelligibly, then sang and finger-drummed a powwow rhythm on the bar top. I didn't know him. He wasn't a member of my small tribe, but I was deeply embarrassed. We were the only Indians in the place. We were connected by race and culture, if not by tribe and blood. My white friends were visibly distressed by that loud singer and drummer. One of my friends, whom I shall call Tara, leaned forward and whispered, "I hate Indians." My 4 other white friends gasped, but it took Tara a few moments to remember that she was sitting beside me, her Indian friend. She burst into tears and spent the rest of the night apologizing. "It's okay," I kept saying, but it wasn't. I was hurt, ashamed, and angry. If I'd had parents I trusted, I might have hurried home and shared that experience with them. I might have learned about all of the times they dealt with overt and covert racism. They might have taught me strategies for how to emotionally and physically deal with racism. But I didn't have parents like that. I didn't believe then, and I don't believe now, that my father and mother would have offered useful advice to me. I had to live as an Indian in the anti-Indian world without proper training. I had to teach myself how to practice racial self-defense. And I made some profound, amateurish mistakes. Tara and I eventually dated for nearly 3 years. We talked about marriage. We lived together. She was always kind. I gave her a promise ring that I bought for $20 in a pawn shop. When we broke up for the last time, she gave me back that promise ring, and I sold it for $10 back to that pawn shop. That pawn shop is closed now. What happens to the inventory of a closing pawn shop? I would guess it is sold to another pawn shop. A pawn shop buys a pawn shop. I imagine that a poor man, as poor or poorer than I was, eventually bought that promise ring and gave it to the woman he loved. That promise ring, small and lovely and inexpensive, is probably now buried in the jewelry box of that woman, who received a better ring when her husband could afford it later in their life together. But she keeps that first ring as a reminder of who she used to be. I was once an Indian boy who was once in love with a white girl who once hated Indians. This is a love story, I think. Chapter 77. Shush. During high school, my white girlfriend's mother warned her to never go to the reservation with me. Why not? I asked my girlfriend. My mom said that Indians are too angry. Laughing at the casual racism, I later told my mother what my girlfriend had said. What your girlfriend's mother doesn't know, my mother said, is that you're the Indian around here who has the worst temper. Because of my childhood hydrocephalus and resultant brain surgery and 7 years of seizures, petite and grand, along with addiction to several painkillers and sedatives, I was prone to blackout rages where somebody bigger had to sit on me to keep me from running through walls. I once spent hours repeatedly crashing into a smallish pine tree until it broke and fell. That was me, the lumberjack of irrational anger, the axe of self-destructive wounding, the sharp blade of get me the fuck out of here. That white girlfriend never did visit my reservation home. But I married a Native American woman, a powerful Hidatsa, who'd spent time on my reservation before I met her. Before I went to your res, my wife said, all the Indians in Spokane, all the Indians who weren't Spokane, said you Spokanes were mean. And, I asked, you Spokanes are mean, my wife said. Not with fists, but with words. I never met Indians so good at teasing each other, at burning people with insults. What about me? I asked. Am I mean? You aren't mean to me with words, she said. You're mean to me with your silences. Wow, I said, feeling seen. You know, there was a 3-year period in college when my mother and I didn't say a word to each other, even if we were in the same room, even if we were in the same car. Why did you guys stop talking? I don't remember, I said. What made you start talking again? I don't remember that either. You should ask your mom, my wife said. Maybe she remembers. Asking my mom about a fight, I said, is like asking my mom to fight again. We probably stopped talking to each other because I reminded her of some other time when we weren't talking to each other. You're scared of your mother, aren't you? My wife asked. Yes, I said. So am I, my wife said. And we laughed. Chapter 78. Harvest. The day after my big sister's burial on the reservation, after my mother had collapsed in grief 5 or 6 times, I returned to my farmtown school. The white kids, my friends and fellow 8th graders, shook my hand, patted me on the back, said awkward and graceful things. They were reticent in the presence of grief. They were polite about my pain. I didn't understand it. I'd been raised by a mother who was so emotionally expansive. She often wildly expressed the wrong emotion, but at least she was always emotive. I'd seen my drunken father weeping and incoherently singing love songs while pissing his pants. So yeah, I had no relationship with reticence. A year after my sister's death, one of my white classmates died in a car wreck. His name was Donnie Piper. He was a farm kid who wore Western shirts and cowboy boots every day. A constant smiler, he had a locker always filled with cans of Pepsi and bags of nacho cheese Doritos. And he generously shared his junk food. On certain days, when there'd been no money for breakfast or lunch, Donnie's soda and chips were my only meal. Nobody at Reardon knew I was that poor. I never let any of them know when I was hungry. Though I qualified for free lunch, I never went to the cafeteria. I worried that being poor would negatively affect my social standing. Poverty kids are never popular kids, right? My entire class, all 50 of us, went to Donnie's funeral. I sat in a back pew and cried for a while. I liked Donnie. I would miss him. He died so young. And because I'd already been to a few dozen wakes and funerals, it felt as if all of the separate grief had become one ever-growing grief. As if each grief was worse than the previous grief because of exponential math. So it felt like my grief for Donnie was the same size as all the rest of my grief combined. Plus one. But I stopped crying when I noticed that very few people were being openly emotional. I'd never seen that many stoic people at a funeral. My tribe doesn't bury our dead that way. We wail, weep, and tell dirty jokes at graveside. I was completely shocked to see that Donnie's immediate family, little brother, mother, father, and grandparents, were sitting off to the side behind a black mesh screen. I could barely make out their features. They were grieving separately from the rest of us. I was boggled. How do people grieve if they're not grieving with the entire community? How do they grieve in a separate room? I didn't doubt the epic size of their pain. I didn't judge the quality of their grief. I was simply baffled by their ceremonies. That was the first time I truly understood that I was a foreigner. I might have been indigenous to the land itself, but I was a first-generation cultural immigrant to the United States. I was now living in a place where people did not grieve like me. Later, back at school, I was even more shocked to learn that it was the first funeral that most of my classmates had ever attended. Donnie Piper was their first death. I thought they were kidding. But no, it was true. My white classmates knew very little about death. We didn't keep a tally, but based on the stories I remember from that day, I think I might have attended more funerals than all of my white classmates put together. Later that week, the teacher asked me to take attendance while she left the room for other business. I quickly ran through the names, A through O. And then I said, "Donnie Piper." The room was so quiet. "Donnie Piper," I asked. "Donnie." I was oblivious to my mistake. "Donnie," I asked, "are you here?" And then I realized that I'd been waiting for a response from my dead friend. So ashamed, so hurt, I put my head down on my desk and wept. Nobody said a word. Not then or later. None of the people in that classroom ever mentioned that incident to me. I was not reprimanded, teased, or consoled. I was left alone to feel my own emotions. So I cried for a few minutes, sat up, and finished taking roll. A year earlier, on that day after my sister's burial, I sat at my desk and wondered how I would ever be happy without my sister in my life. She was the only one who'd ever thought I'd be a writer. I scoffed at the notion. "Indians don't write books," I said. And, as far as I knew, Indians did not write books. I wasn't handed a book written by an Indian until a decade after my sister died. In fourth grade, I wrote a Halloween story for my sister. I don't have a copy of that story, but I remember one line. "As the skeletons boned up the stairs, their bones sounded like powwow bells." Yes, I repeated bones. Yes, I used bones as a noun and verb. My sister screamed when she read that. "Junior," she said to me, "how do you think of shit like that?" "I don't know," I said. "I just close my eyes and I see things with my brain." "You should write a whole book," she said. I laughed at that crazy idea. I was surely not thinking about a writing career as I sat in that eighth grade classroom a day after my sister's burial. I was probably wondering why the hell I was going to school with so many white kids, so many strangers. And then Barb Center walked into the room, saw me sitting at my desk, and gasped. She ran to me, hugged me so tightly that I coughed, and then knelt in front of me. "You're alive," she said. "What?" I asked, confused. "I heard you died." "No," I said. "My sister died." "I didn't hear Sherman's sister died," she said. "I only heard Sherman died." I didn't know what to say. Barb grabbed my hand and said, "I am so sad your sister died. And I am so happy you are alive. I like you. Everybody likes you." She hugged me again. Then other girls, Pam, Rachel, Tiffany, and both Lisas, also hugged me. I had only known those girls for a few months. I think I was probably too shy to hug them back. But they hugged me. And Barb's words echoed in my ears. Barb Center's words still echo. My sister was dead. I was mostly a stranger in that school. I would become good friends with most of those kids. And most of those friendships went into suspended animation when we graduated from high school. I remain lifelong friends with a few of those kids, who are now middle-aged adults like me. But I think I have only seen Barb twice in the last 31 years. And yet, I often think of her. She was the first person to ever look at me, to sincerely make eye contact and say, "I like you." And I'm still flabbergasted that she also said, "Everybody likes you." That next year, on our first day as freshmen, I was unanimously elected class president. Donnie Piper would die later that school year. But on that day, he raised his hand and voted for me. I am weeping now as I write this, as I remember that morning. I was sitting at a desk and watched all of my classmates, white people, raise their hands to vote for me. Those 49 raised arms turned that classroom into an odd garden, and I proudly stood, and I bloomed. Chapter 79, The Game. But 36 years after those white conservative kids in Reardon unanimously elected me freshman class president, I wonder how many of them voted for the racist, sexist, homophobic, and immoral Donald Trump to be United States president. How many of their parents and siblings voted for Trump. How many of my former teachers voted for Trump. Reardon High School is located in Lincoln County, the whitest and most conservative county in Washington. Trump won 72% of the Lincoln County vote. So I assume that percentage holds true among my former Reardon classmates and their families who still live in the area. Based on my anonymous looks at their social media postings, I also assume that percentage holds true, or close to true, for those people who moved away from Reardon to Spokane, Seattle, Alaska, Arizona, Montana, Idaho, Oregon, New York, and various other places. Of the dozens of Reardon folks I still know, I am aware of only 5 who are vocal and active Democrats. How do I make sense of this? How is it possible that I, the lifelong indigenous liberal, became so popular, so loved and loving in that conservative community? How did I become captain of the basketball team, prom royalty, and president of the Future Farmers of America? Was it because I had a killer jump shot and spin move on the basketball court? Was it because I was once handsome and slender enough to be called pretty, despite all my real and perceived scars? Was it because I could publicly speak my mind with quick wit and honesty? Was it because I was so book smart? Was it because I was mostly kind and egalitarian and made friends with stoners, jocks, musicians, geeks, brainiacs, and all other manner of kids? Was it because many of those kids, like me, were athletic and geeky and academically ambitious all at the same time? My senior year, the varsity basketball team had an average GPA of 3.76. Out of the 12 guys on that team, 11 of us went on to get bachelor's degrees. The women's basketball team had that same level of academic accomplishment. This kind of scholarly achievement might be standard for an urban private school, but it seems improbable for a farm town public high school of 150 kids in a community of 1,500 people. So perhaps I was the beneficiary of a white small town's honest meritocracy. I was good at everything that a Reardon kid was supposed to be good at. I could have simultaneously been portrayed as the nerd hero and compassionate jock in a 1980s teen movie. So maybe that made my indigenous and liberal identities of secondary importance to those white kids and their parents. But I wonder if my race would have been more of an issue if I'd been a non-athlete, if I'd been only an average student, if I'd been plain or overweight or socially awkward, or if I hadn't been such a natural diplomat. I was the best or among the best in the school at nearly every academic and extracurricular activity, though I never did repair that small engine in shop class, and yes, yes, I twice set myself on fire while arc welding. So it was demonstrably impossible for anybody in Reardon to think of me as inferior to any of those white kids. I think I overwhelmed most overt or latent racism with the sheer force and size of my abilities. But was I also accepted because it's difficult to be actively racist, sexist, or homophobic on a one-to-one basis? It's hard to be anti-Indian when an Indian is sitting next to you in a classroom. Though I did learn it's pretty easy for a white conservative father and mother to be vocally anti-Indian when their daughter is dating a res boy like me. But damn, after high school and college and a decade into my very public and leftist artistic career, the town of Reardon asked me to be the grand marshal for their community day parade. I said yes, of course, and proudly rode on a mule-driven wagon through town while waving at so many of my old friends and teachers. How did that happen? How did all of those future Trump voters, all of those folks willing to validate and empower that rich man's bigotry, come to celebrate the poor brown boy who grew up in their white town? I know the answer has a lot to do with basic human decency, and also with the seductive nature of fame. But I think the answer has most to do with compartmentalism. It's easy for a white racist to fall in love with and accept one member of a minority, one Indian, and their real and perceived talents and flaws. But it's much tougher for a racist to accept a dozen Indians, and impossible for a white racist to accept the entire race of Indians, or an entire race of any non-white people. I would guess, perhaps too optimistically, that nearly every racist believes it is morally wrong to be racist. And since nearly every person thinks of themselves as being moral, then a racist must consciously and subconsciously employ tortured logic in order to explain away their racism, in order to believe themselves to be non-racist. I have lost track of the number of times a white person, hilariously thinking they were being complimentary, has said to me, "But Sherman, I don't think of you as an Indian." Throughout my rural and urban life among white conservatives and white liberals, I've heard many other variations on that same basic sentiment. "Sherman, you're not like other Indians. Sherman, you're a credit to your race. Sherman, you barely seem Indian. Sherman, I don't think of you as being Indian. I think of you as being a person. Sherman, you're not just a native writer. You're a writer. Sherman, I don't see color. I see the person inside." All of these statements mean the same thing. "Sherman, in order to fit you and your indigenous identity into my worldview, I have to think of you as being like me, as being white like me." I suspect that some of my white friends, if they are listening to this, don't recognize themselves as a person who has said such racist things directly to me, who cannot even recognize the racism present in such statements. In being friends with white people, I've always had to live entirely inside their circle of experience, inside their white world. And my white friends have rarely, if ever, spent even a moment in my indigenous world. This inequality in my friendships has a lot to do with my own introverted nature. I am far more emotionally available when performing on stage and in the books I write than I am in person. But it happens mostly because being American means being white, even for a brown boy like me. So at Reardon High School, I was successful and acceptable and loved because I was, and still am, great at negotiating with whiteness. But that means my white friends often mistakenly believe that my ability to successfully negotiate the white world means that I am white, or more white than native. My white friends can mistakenly believe that my intellectual and artistic abilities are intrinsically white. And yes, I am heavily influenced by Whitman, Dickinson, Springsteen, Hank Williams, and Dusty Springfield, and owe them and many other white and non-native artists and intellectuals a huge debt. But I am also very much a product of my ancient tribal culture. I am the genetic, artistic, and political descendant of my mother and father, and grandmother, and thousands of years of salmon fishing ancestors. But here, I must also indict the strange anti-Indian racism of many Native Americans who have, over my nearly 25-year literary career, sought to discount, discredit, and demolish me as a writer and as an indigenous person. These are the natives who, like white racists, mistakenly attribute my success to my perceived whiteness. These are the natives who cannot believe that a reservation-raised boy could ever become the man I am. A few years into my career, and in the early, less universal age of the internet, a rumor started that I wasn't a real Indian. That I was actually adopted and raised by a white family. Of course, that falsehood was primarily a grievous insult to those indigenous people, like one of my first cousins, who were taken from their birth families and given to white folks, an act of bureaucratic genocide so commonplace that the U.S. government needed to pass the Indian Child Welfare Act in order to stop the practice. But this mythology about white parentage was told about me, a native man who grew up with two native parents on his tribe's reservation and a government-built house located across the street from the tribal school. If my wholly indigenous identity can be viewed with suspicion in the past, present, and future, then I sigh and grieve at the heinous shit that other natives endure because they have a white parent, or grew up in the city, or failed to meet some other imaginary standard of Indianness. And I laugh when I think about my wife, Diane Hidatsa Ho-Chunk Potawatomi, who called her sister after our first date and said, "He's way young and way res." And I think of the continent-sized leap I took in my early teens when I left the reservation school to attend Reardon. I was a courageous explorer, scholarly adventurist, and terrified child. And none of you, native or not, would have ever heard of me if I had not taken that first step onto the moon. I have been harshly judged by other natives who were either too scared to take that step, or who somehow think their first step was more pure, more Indian, than mine. What does it feel like to experience such hypocritical anger from other natives? Well, if dealing with white anti-Indian racists is like soft-shoeing through a minefield, then facing anti-Indian Indians is like dodging bullets from camouflaged snipers, sneaky and deadly. But very few of even the most cruel Indians voted for Trump. So I must recall the ways in which my race and my indigenous identity did become problematic when I attended Reardon High School and spent 5 years in Trump country. I remember how my parliamentary procedure team coach and teammates sometimes called me Chief Gayfeather. And yes, that's an obviously racist and homophobic insult. But it was also, impossibly enough, an affectionate acknowledgement and gentle mocking of my Native American identity and highly emotive personality. In high school, as now, I cried more easily than most people. I wrote poems and stories. I constantly expressed my love for people, places, and things. I was affectionate. So, when viewed through the hyper-masculine lens of white small-town America, my emotional vulnerability was sometimes perceived as being stereotypically homosexual. One would think that an androgynous Indian boy would be tortured in a farm town high school. But I was the androgynous and popular Indian boy who led that debate team to a state championship and made out with two of my female teammates separately while on road trips to debate meets. I would love to say I also made out with one of my male teammates because it would make for a more dynamic story. But alas, I've always been approximately 84% straight. Chief Gayfeather. I'm sure that shit would get students suspended and teachers fired in Reardon today, but it was acceptable in the 1980s. In some sad-ass spasm of self-denigration and self-preservation, I accepted that shit too. I also remember a basketball game we played against Freeman High School where I recognized one of the refs as we did warm-up drills. He had been for years notoriously and obviously biased against reservation high school teams. And though I was the only native on my team, and my parents were the only native fans sitting in the bleachers, I knew that ref would still practice his official form of anti-Indian racism on me. So I told my coach, a white man, of my suspicions about that racist ref. I don't think my coach believed me. But that ref called a foul on me during the opening jump ball, then called two more fouls on me in the next 2 minutes, and then called the fourth and fifth fouls on me. The Freeman coach had understood what was happening and had ordered his players to purposefully run into me and flop like soccer players. I was sitting on the bench, disqualified by fouls, before the fourth quarter. After the game, which my team won without me, my coach pulled me aside in the locker room and said he was sorry about what happened. He didn't directly call it racism, but he tacitly acknowledged it. I also remember a Future Farmers of America extemporaneous speech contest, where three judges ruled that I either won first or second place, while the fourth judge put me in sixth and last place. Her strange decision and low score meant I finished in third place and missed out on a trip to the state finals, because only the top two finishers moved on. Afterward, we looked at her scorecard and saw that she deducted points for my long hair and distracting foreign accent. Well, my hair was not quite as short as my competitor's crew cuts, but my sing-song speaking voice could only be considered foreign if one thinks the Spokane Indian Reservation is an international destination. I also remember when an adult community member in Reardon publicly objected to me being named basketball team captain. He said, in my presence, that only a local boy should be captain. I wish I'd been rowdy enough to point out that I'd been local for at least 45,000 years. This is the same guy who, after he read my novel about my first year in Reardon, wrote me to ask why I had to invent racist white characters. And I also remember the pep rally where my great friend and fellow Spokane Indian and basketball star, Steve, and I were wildly cheered by our classmates. Steve had transferred to Reardon the year after I did and had become quite popular, too. As Steve and I were being celebrated, one of our white teammates leaned over and said, "You let two Indians in and they think they own the place." Once again, I wish I'd been rowdy enough to tell my teammate to shut the fuck up, because Spokane Indians had inhabited, if not officially owned, that very land for millennia. Of course, I could tell you far more stories about the kindness of many Reardon folks than about the racism of a select few. And I could also tell you about the incongruent kindness of some racists. But I must point out that I was most often subjected to active and passive racism when I threatened the status quo, when I was the native student who was smarter than the white kids, or when I was a better basketball player, or debater, or actor, or comedian, or public speaker, or most revealingly, when a white girl fell in romantic like or love with me. In Reardon, I was subjected to racism when certain white folks feared I was taking something away from them. I was subjected to racism when certain white folks were afraid of me, the indigenous usurper. So, in the context of the 2016 presidential election, does any of this sound familiar? In 2016, white conservatives elected as president a serial liar who was likely the most fearful and paranoid and wildly insecure white man who has ever run for the office. And those white folks elected him because they believe they are victims. Yes, I am a Spokane Indian, an indigenous American who grew up with white folks who think this country is being stolen from them. Ha 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 ha. I wonder if I could have changed a few votes if I'd campaigned for Hillary Clinton and Reardon and the rest of Lincoln County. I completely doubt it. I graduated high school over 3 decades ago and haven't stopped or spent any time in Reardon for over 11 years. The last I heard, my books are not taught in the school because they are inappropriate for the intended audience. I wonder what my old Reardon friends think of me. I would guess they're proud of my success, but chagrined and unsurprised by my continuing liberalism. I wonder if any of them thought about me when they voted for Trump. I wonder if they remember how much they loved and were loved by me. I wonder if they know they've helped place me, a public figure brown-skinned liberal, in danger. How much of that danger is real? I don't know. I am getting death threats. But I am more afraid of the quieter forms of right-wing anger and sociopathy that have found power with Donald Trump's election. I never directly feared for my life and career during a Republican presidency until Trump won the office. I have never felt so scared for the peace and safety of the entire world. And I fear that Reardon, the place where I was so loved and accepted and celebrated, is now just another little white town that I, in the name of personal and professional safety, might need to avoid. Dear Reardon, I am afraid of you. Does that make you sad or angry at me? Dear Reardon, dear old friends, dear old lovers. Do you realize that when you voted for Trump, you voted against me? Against the memory of the person I used to be in your lives? I was the indigenous immigrant, the first generation of my family to ever fully commit himself to the world outside of the reservation. I was the eccentric brown boy. I was the indigenous leftist. And, for 5 years in the 1980s, I was a transformative figure. I made that little white town into a slightly more diverse and inclusive and accepting place. Or maybe I didn't do any of that. Maybe I was just a cultural anomaly. And though many natives, many Spokanes, have attended Reardon since I graduated and have maintained friendships and marriages with white people, I wonder if all of that is superficial. I wonder if my friendships in Reardon have always been superficial. Maybe I was loved only because of the ways in which I was not seen as typically and stereotypically native. Maybe I was loved only in part. Maybe I was celebrated only in proportion to the positive press I brought to that town and school. And maybe, in this Trump era, I would now be ostracized and vilified in Reardon for being who I have always been. In order to survive, I always knew I'd have to leave the tribe of my birth, leave the limited and limiting Spokane Indian Reservation. But I am only now realizing that in order to keep surviving, I also had to flee from my other place of birth, from the equally limited and limiting Reardon, from all those white folks who became another tribe for me. I have always been an escape artist. Escaping is what I do. So, old Reardon friends, if you don't hear from me for a while, then it means I am trying to escape you. Chapter 80. I am my own parasite. I dreamed that my spine was a spider and my ribs were its legs. It revolted and molted me, leaving me husked in the dirt. While I put on my two best trousers and two best shirts and scuttled onto the stage to claim that my rage and all of my stories and poems hatched from its eggs. Chapter 81. Tribal Ties. Please remember, as you read my brutal poems about rape and murder and assault and dangerous loneliness ripped from the earth like uranium, please remember, as you read these poems about my dead mother and my dead father and all of my childhood pandemonium, please remember, as I weep inside my verse, that nearly every Indian kid I knew had it worse. Chapter 82. Want List. I don't want to miss my mother. I don't want my want to be tangible. I don't want my tangible want to be elemental. I don't want my mother to be a baptismal fire. I don't need my mother to be clay and silt. I don't need my mother to be that basalt ridge. I don't need my mother to be that evergreen. I don't need my mother like I need the enduring earth. I don't love minor chords. I don't love every piano in the world. I don't love my stereo's choir. I don't love my mother as much as I love song drunk air. I don't grieve everybody that I have lost. I don't grieve dammed and dammed rivers. I don't grieve my way like a salmon through the dark. I don't grieve my mother like I grieve the sacred waters. I don't grieve my mother. I don't grieve my mother. I don't grieve my mother. I don't place my mother upon the pyre. Yes, I do. Yes, I do. I'm a goddamn liar. Chapter 83. The Staging. In the weeks after my mother's death, I sleep 4 or 5 hours a night, often interrupted by dreams, and take 2 or 3 naps a day.